At its very core, drug science must remain independent. This means we don't accept sponsorships. It's with the support of the drug science community we're able to do this and make the podcast in the first place. If you're able to become a drug science community member and support the show, you too will be supporting the dissemination of evidence-based drug policies. Without you, none of this would be possible. For anybody interested, there's a link in the show notes. Thank you. Hello and welcome to the Drug Science Podcast with me, David Nutt. Here we're bringing together experts and activists for a rational, honest and informed conversation about drugs.
A Fascinate Productions podcast for drug science.
Today, I'm talking with a philosopher. His name is Peter Sajdet-Hughes. He's at the University of Exeter. And his particular research interest is in the relationship of psychedelics and philosophy. So welcome, Peter.
Thank you, David. Pleasure to speak with you again.
Yes, we were on a panel, weren't we, at How the Light Gets In, I think.
Yeah.
And we realised that there's more overlap between psychedelics and philosophy than I might have imagined. And why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and how you got into this field, and then we'll talk about the field itself.
Yeah, okay. Well, I studied Western philosophy when, you know, as a bachelor, got into sort of the Germans, mostly Kant and so on, as a master's. And then I got into the philosophy of mind. And then I got a job in London teaching philosophy and at a college there in South Kensington. One part of that was, well, the college roped me into doing philosophy of religion, which was not really my area. But I thought, yeah, okay, I'll give it a go. You know, I'll look and research it. And part of the research was William James, especially his varieties of religious experience, you see. But I had never really had a so-called mystical experience. But then when I came back to Cornwall on a holiday, we went through some fields for a walk here in Western Cornwall. And my brother, who's an amateur mycologist, said, listen, Peter, I think those are some magic mushrooms there. And I thought, maybe I can, for academic purposes, I can... you know, maybe try these out and get a experiential account of what William James was saying. So I picked about 100, which, and I've never found more since, you know, in one spot.
Strip them out.
Yeah. And I you know, looked them up on the internet to make sure they were, you know, legitimate, not poisonous, whatever, and they seemed the real deal. And dried them, took them back to London, took a small amount, first of all, just to make sure, you know, I wouldn't die. I went to the cinema, saw an amazing 3D film, which I later realized wasn't in 3D. And then I took a big dose after that. And it was a life-changing experience, incredibly, well, you know all about that, the incredible psychedelic experience. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, okay, I'm gonna look at the philosophy of mind literature, you know, in relation to the psychedelic experience, to sort of find out more about this. And I was surprised that there was relatively little literature on it. So then I thought, okay, well, someone has to take a stab at this. So that's what got me involved, really, maybe 10 years ago or so. Since then, I did a PhD in Exeter, lecturer there now, associate lecturer, research fellow, and I'm organising the first ever Philosophy of Psychedelics conference in Exeter University, which was scheduled a few months ago, but it got postponed, obviously, due to this virus. But it will take place now in April 2021.
Good. We'll make sure that plug goes out on the tweet. No, seriously, very important. It's the first ever. But as you say, when you started looking into it, you kind of realised that actually you weren't the first. It's hard to know who was the first, but... possibly William James. And now, I mean, I'm a great fan of William James. As presumably, are you a fan of his?
Oh yeah, massively. I mean, he's extremely influential. Alfred North Whitehead, another philosopher I'm keen on, he says William James had never had a system, but he had these incredibly insightful glimpses into the human condition. And, you know, you always get something new every time you read him. Brilliant writer, very insightful. And, scholarly at the same time.
So we understand, I think, I mean, you probably know more than I do, that he used to, I think he probably tried mescaline and I think he tried nitrous oxide, and it was from those that he began to say things like, there's more than one kind of consciousness. Yeah. The problem is how to actually explore them. And
Well, one of his criteria for defining the mystical experience, as he calls it in the for us, his religious experience is ineffability, you know, that you can't find words for this. But he says that, and then he spends another, 100 pages writing about it. So it's not quite true.
He's desperately trying to find the word.
That's it. Well, Humphrey Davy before him also spoke about ineffability. I mean, this was...
Probably not everyone knows who Humphrey Davy is. Mm. So do you want to give us a little potted history? Because he's one of my heroes also.
How is he? Yeah, no, I assume that merely because I've lived under his shadow. I mean, literally, for many years, his statue crowns the high street of Penzance, which is a westerly city, town. He called himself a chemical philosopher, which is a term I know we both love. And I mean, in those days, so I'm talking 200 years ago now or more, there was not this distinction between science and philosophy that we have today. So he was brought up in Penzance, but he went to Bristol, Clifton, to study gases, which were the big, you know, the big cure-all at the time. So they believed. We'd call him today a chemist. He's famous in Cornwall for inventing the miner's safety lamp.
Right.
Saved many people, and that's on his statue now, this lamp. Yeah, so one of the gases he tried was nitrous oxide, and at the time it was believed, I mean, this is 1799, it was believed that it was poisonous, but he took a bit and quite enjoyed it, and he took a bit more, and eventually on Boxing Day in 1799, he stepped into this TARDIS, really, and took 160 pints of the gas. And as he stepped out, he took another 40 pints, for good measure. And a sort of,
so he immersed himself. He went into a sealed room, immersed himself in nitrous oxide. Okay.
That's right. And
that's laughing gas for those people who don't know.
And and as a result of it, he said, nothing exists but thoughts. So he came to this, what we call in philosophy, idealist position, that mind was fundamental over matter. Of course, at the time, German idealism was taking hold in Britain. He was friends with Coleridge and Wordsworth, people like that, who were very much into German idealism. But nonetheless, it's interesting that the first time he took it, he was led to this, or at least became more certain about this particular philosophical position.
And he coined the term chemical philosopher, did he?
To my knowledge, I mean, he calls himself that.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
And of course, in those days, everything was legal, so it was no problem. You were discovering things, and that was all that mattered, really.
Yeah, and he also tried other gases like carbon monoxide, which wasn't that pleasant, you know.
He's lucky to be alive.
In a way, yeah, yeah. He also took a lot of opium, and he wrote this great book in 1829, Confessions of a Philosopher. And the first chapter is like a psychedelic trip. I mean, it's a great piece of literature, certainly worth reading. Actually, no, it's called The Last Days of a Philosopher.
Is it still in print?
I think so, yeah. I got a copy. And I mean, it was published in 1830, written in 1829. He died in 1829, so posthumous.
So you're going to argue he was the beginnings of 200 years of philosophers or chemists or pharmacologists like me getting insights into brain and consciousness through drugs.
Yeah, I mean, I've called him the first psychedelic scientist. I think that's fair.
Yeah, other people talk about Hefter as that, because he was the first person to isolate what we would call a kind of classic psychedelic now, wouldn't he?
That's true, yeah.
Which was mescaline.
I mean, this is a question of how you define psychedelics. I mean, you know, are they just tryptamines or do you extend more? I mean, there was Thomas de Quincey of the same time as well. He was wrote Confessions of an English Opium Eater. And of course, we don't normally call opium a psychedelic, but some of the experiences were pretty psychedelic. Mm-hmm. He was also a Kantian idealist. He was one of the first English commenters on Kant's philosophy as well. So there's this interesting beginnings of philosophy and psychedelic experimentation in Britain, especially.
And we were leading the world then.
Yeah, but then everyone sort of forgot about it.
Well, then we had James. Of course, he was American. Mm. And I mean, most people don't know that he had insights about consciousness from using drugs like nitrous oxide and mescaline.
It's quite interesting. He said only through nitrous oxide did he understand Hegel's philosophy, William James said. And Hegel's philosophy is a type of idealism as well. So very much like Humphrey Davy. But these connections which were made early on were sort of lost. And that's why it was a bit surprising to find that there is not much literature on it. Of course, there is James and a bit of Davy and so on, but relatively little.
Do you think it was lost or was it suppressed? Presumably it became politically very dangerous, you know, to research these things.
Yeah. I mean, two reasons really interwoven, which was that in the in the mid-20th century, you know, with the first psychedelic wave in the West, really, philosophy was in a very eliminativist, reductivist phase in terms of mind. So in those days, it was very common to think of consciousness as an illusion, or as the words for mental states being merely reference to forms of behavior and so on. So unfortunately, just when everyone got, you know, with Leary and so on, when everyone got interested in psychedelic experience, philosophy of mind was at its most sort of reductivist stage.
I see.
So they didn't come together then. Was there suppression? I mean, obviously, the then the criminalization of psychedelic use stopped funding, and also the propaganda about their dangers stopped philosophers from messing with their minds, as they might have believed. There was actually one interesting event that might have happened. It didn't, unfortunately, but there was. It was Huxley and Osmond, and with some help from Smithies and others, to create the Outsight Project, which was a project...
Outsight,
yeah. So it was a project in the mid-1950s to bring together 100 leading thinkers, including Einstein and Jung and H.H. Price and Graham Greene even, and A.J. Eyre. Anyway, and to give them all mescaline.
Yeah,
and then convey that experience to the world. So there could have been, and they wanted funding from the Ford Foundation, but they didn't. They almost got it, but they didn't in the end, unfortunately. So then that went quiet until 10 years later. Timothy Leary, of course, made a big song and dance about it, and then got out of hand, it seems.
He didn't quite have the same credentials as Einstein.
No.
I think it would be fascinating. If Einstein had started campaigning for the use of psychedelics, maybe even the FDA would have listened.
I think if that Outsight event, if it had occurred, then the whole history after that would be very different, and it would be much more academically respectable to look into these things. Unfortunately, what happened, of course, as we all know, it became sort of mainstream, linked with hippie demographic, which Nixon was very much against, of course, then became criminalized through the war of drugs. And now we think of psychedelic experience in terms of criminality and recreation and so on, which is unfortunate because they are, of course, massive expanders of consciousness.
I mean, there are, I'm sure, philosophers who say, yeah, but it's all just a drug effect, isn't it? What do you say to them?
It's all a drug effect with consciousness. Well, yeah, okay, so here we come to philosophy of mind.
Yeah, go on then. So how... Be gentle with us, be gentle, right?
All right. So philosophy, I mean, there are different approaches to the mind. As you know, there's neuroscience, there's psychology, different psychologies. Philosophy of mind is another way. There's theology as well, of course. Philosophy of mind, the main question really, ultimately, is what is the relation between matter and mind? How do we understand it? And there are, I think, five main responses to that question. The one that that is default in the West today, due to our history, I think, starting with Descartes, is physicalism or materialism, which is that the fundamental blocks of the universe are matter. Another popular response is dualism, which is that there are two fundamental substances, which are matter and mind. So the soul and the body. This, of course, is common in the religious field. You know, so the soul can leave the body when it's dead. Yes. There's a third option, which is idealism, which I mentioned in relation to Davy and James.
Well, could you just maybe explain a little bit more, because I don't know what that means.
Idealism. Okay, so it really should be called ideaism. The epitome of it is from the philosopher Immanuel Kant, who lived 200 years ago. And it's this, the idea is that mind is fundamental, the fundamental aspect of the universe, and we project what we consider to be matter onto reality. So it's as if we're projecting the space and time and causality around us. But ultimately, the real thing is mind. So this is idealism. As I say, it was popular in Germany 200 years ago and became popular in the early 1900s, late 1800s in Cambridge. You had people like MacTaggart, who was very much influenced by it.
Okay, right, good. That's three. And what were the
other
two?
That's three. A fourth one is panpsychism. I mean, these interweave with idealism and dualism to a certain extent, and physicalism. But panpsychism is a view that mind is inherent within matter. So all of matter has very primitive, basic, primal forms of mind, by which I don't mean the consciousness of what you did last weekend with your friends, obviously in a human sense, mm-hmm. but, you know, primitive, something akin to perhaps a subconscious. So plants would, in this panpsychism, plants would have a primitive form of maybe mm-hmm. a sensation and some kind of pleasure, perhaps pain. This is what the ancient, many ancient Greeks believed, like Plato.
It's definitely becoming fashionable again, I say. New Scientist has something on this about every other week.
Right, yeah, yeah. I mean, Christoph Koch is a panpsychist now explicitly. Uh-huh. Tononi, arguably. It's entering the scientific field. It's become popular in philosophy. Yeah. I'm quite sympathetic to it. And William James, I should say, towards the end of his career, became a panpsychist in a book called mm-hmm. The Pluralistic Universe. There's that option. And then the fifth one is what one can call neutral monism, which is that, well, two forms of it really. One is that mind and matter emerge from a neutral substance, so neither mind nor matter, or mm-hmm. mind and matter are both different aspects of something greater, uh-huh. like in Spinoza's philosophy perhaps. But like I say, that you divide these up in order to teach them and to get people to yes. get the basic views. But in reality, they're all very much interwoven. So Spinoza is also known as a panpsychist. He's also known as a physicalist, for that matter. So come back to your original question then, when people say, yeah, but it's just machinations of the brain or something, you know, a certain experience. I mean, that assumes that the fundamental aspect of reality is matter. When you say the brain, you mean the material brain, mm-hmm. right? And this is problematic. I mean, all of those five responses to the mind-matter mystery are problematic. And so I've got certainty in none of them. However,
that's presumably why there are so many of them, because you can't,
exactly.
none of them is completely satisfactory.
Precisely. But, you know, physicalism, which I was brought up here in England mostly. I mean, this is sort of not, it wasn't spoken about like, this is what we believe and what you have to believe. It's rather, this was a default view. And of course, you know, not doing philosophy in English schools, you don't realize any problems with it. But there are many problems. For example, I mean, there are different forms of physicalism. Is mind identical to matter? Does mind emerge mm-hmm. from matter, which is a prevalent view? And when you say that mind emerges mm-hmm. from matter, what do you mean by that? It's not something that is observable, obviously. And we don't have mm-hmm. bridge laws to explain that. So it's sort of not scientific in that sense. And also, that, you know, as well as this so-called upward causation, we also have the problem of downward causation or mental causation, which is how does the mind, thinking, desiring, mm-hmm. calculating, planning things, mm. how can that possibly have any effect on the brain? Because, you know, there's no known mental force in nature. It's not part of the scientific point of view.
To paraphrase you, you mean, how can our thought turn into action? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. What is that process?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's and it's very problematic because, you know, there's two main responses to that. One is you deny it. You, like, people deny free will and they say, well, it's just an illusion. Mm-hmm. The problem with that, though, is that there's an evolutionary argument against it, for example, from Karl Popper, which is, why would we have evolved the mind at all if it has no power? Mm. Also, it seems counterintuitive, of course. You know, when you're really trying to work something out, like Hegel or whatever, you know, it's, that effort, that mental effort, that is completely impotent. Just seems very counterintuitive. And also, surely our human intelligence changes, has, you know, improved our civilization. I mean, the conscious intelligence, you know. So very few people are willing to endorse the fact that there's no mental causation, known as epiphenomenalism. Mm. It was Thomas Huxley who came up with that, in fact, which was Aldous Huxley's grandfather.
Yeah.
So he said that the epiphenomenalism is the view that consciousness is like the steam coming out of a locomotive. You know, it just has no power whatsoever. But that's got a lot of problems in evolutionary terms. And so then you're back with, okay, we accept mental causation, but then the problem is, how does one explain it in a physicalist framework if one is to maintain a physicalist framework? And so the other response then is you say, okay, let's start again. Let's then reject that physicalist framework and see if there are more parsimonious ways of explaining this relationship between mind and matter. Panpsychism is one of those.
We'll get back to the interview in just a second. I just want to thank all the Drug Science community members for your continued support. Without you, the dissemination of information like this would not be possible. Drug Science is, and always will be, independent. This means we don't accept sponsorships. But by becoming a Drug Science community member, you'll be helping us bring about change. You'll also receive access to exclusive events and will be able to attend all drug science events for free. To see how to become a community member, click on the link in the show notes. Now, where were we? Let's get back to the show. Are these currently taught in undergraduate philosophy courses? Is the philosophy of mind a major theme now in philosophy?
Yeah, it is. It is really. I mean, Descartes, who starts, mm-hmm. you know, is philosophy 101, founder of modern philosophy, founder of modern mathematics, well, for that matter. Philosophy mm-hmm. undergrads, year one, usually starts with the whole thing about, you know, Descartes, I think, therefore I am. And then that mm-hmm. leads to his dualism that mind and matter must be separate because they appear so distinct. And then you have the interaction problem. Well, how do they interact? This is a big problem, right? And then that leads then naturally into philosophy of mind.
I was struck a few years ago, there was a survey of drug use in undergraduates, and they were ranked according to their topic. And what the most remarkable, I think it was 80% of philosophy students had used an illegal drug.
Yeah,
I suppose fits with the idea, you know, you do philosophy because you want to understand things, and drugs somehow facilitate that. But in your experience and your reading, how do drugs facilitate that?
I think in a number of ways. In one way, purely negatively. So, for example, what was prevalent in mid-20th century behaviorism, which is, like I said, the view that mental states don't exist. When we say happy, what we're really referring to is smiling or laughing or jumping or something like this. I mean, immediately, you take a heavy dose of psilocybin and you're sort of floored and you can't move hardly, yeah. but then your phenomenology, your experience is massively expanded. That immediately mm-hmm. pushes that out of the window. Or even other more extreme, I mean, eliminativism in philosophy says that there is no consciousness at all. It's an illusion. I mean, when you have these intense experiences, but these are silly anyway. In other terms, it's well known that psychedelics foster a heightened appreciation of nature. Mm. And now, why would this be necessarily, right? So there are certain metaphysical theories, philosophies that aid the explanation of that. For example, Whitehead's philosophy, he's a type of panpsychist or pan-experientialist. He writes that then all of nature is essentially sentient to different degrees, and valuation is part of that nature. And our normal mode of, we have evolved to emphasize certain forms of sensation, like color and sound and so on. But there is a primitive form of sensation or perception, prehension, he calls it, which takes in exterior valuation. It's absorbed, as it were. Now, this is mostly hidden from us because we are very complicated organisms, as I say. But one explanation of why psychedelics lead to an increased valuation of nature is because they allow for this mode of perception to be amplified, because they take away practical concerns.
Interesting, isn't it? So that sort of fits a little bit with the kind of neuroscience we've done, where you see that psychedelics do disrupt conventional ongoing mental processes, many of which are related to concerns like anxiety and worry.
Mm.
So the brain is kind of getting in the way then,
yeah,
of normal consciousness. Interesting.
That's why your study on psilocybin inhibiting certain neural mechanisms was very much compatible with Bergson's philosophy. And Bergson influenced Aldous Huxley in The Doors of Perception. That was his mode of, mm-hmm. his reference for understanding mm-hmm. the mescaline experience. And it was this, that the function of the body is on the whole eliminative. In other words, it eliminates most of the environment so that we only see that which is of use to us, you know, of evolutionary mm-hmm. use ultimately. In a very basic sense, we don't see most of the frequencies of electromagnetism, for example, because it's of no use mm-hmm. to us. But once one shuts down that practical mechanism, suddenly one is more open to, as it were, more of what is out there. And this is what Bergson argued, and this is what Huxley argued. So it would make sense that taking psychedelics would actually reduce bodily physiological activity. And mm-hmm. that's what you showed, interestingly.
Mm-hmm.
But there's much more work to be done there, of course, to look at the details and so on. And I realize it's all a new science, ultimately. But nonetheless, there are interesting parallels.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. And that's why I wanted you on the program. I'm fascinated by the idea that that this kind of science can inform philosophy. Clearly, you believe it can because you're encouraging that this kind of science.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, at the very least, it can inform our knowledge of the neural correlates of consciousness, which is, you know, an important part of the philosophy of mind, at the very least. And but even more so, it might be able to inform forms of metaphysics. This is what I'm mostly interested in.
Would there be scope for an expanding experimental research to help you? I mean, are there experiments we could do that could help you address some of the issues?
I think there is. But generally speaking, though, with metaphysics and philosophy of mind, the method is usually inference to the best explanation. It's more logical method, you know, that you find in mathematics rather than empirical science. And the reason for that really is another big problem related to the mind-matter mystery, which is the so-called problem of other minds, which is that one can only perceive one's own mind. I can infer what you're thinking by your behavior and your speech and so on, but I can't actually see your mind. Mm. And so when we speak about the mind of other creatures, other humans, but also other animals and so on, the empirical method is, you know, limited really in that sense, because for example, if we were to, let's say I make a proposition that plants have a basic form of sentience. Mm-hmm. There are many new experiments now in terms of sensation. So we know, I was reading recently that certain plants can hear bees around them. Yeah. Leaves can sense a variety of colors. So leaves are, in a sense, eyes and so on. Mm. But of course, that doesn't prove that they have sentience. You know, one could say, well, that's purely mechanistic. And so how would one create an experiment which would show that?
Well, let's stick with humans because we have some idea of how to do experiments with humans. The concept of understanding other people's minds is that people onto psychedelics often have that sense. Mm. One of the podcasts in this series was with Dave Luke, and he's actually trying to do some research on the concept of sort of precognition. That would be an amazing experiment if you could enhance precognition with a psychedelic. That would be, some people would say you could, and if you could do that, that if you could prove that, that would be quite remarkable, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, that would be a good test. I mean, if it was not proved, would it be falsified, though? That'd be an interesting outcome as well.
Yeah, no lose experiment.
one thing I would be interested in, I suppose, is if there were further tests that could show that decreased neural activity was correlated to increased phenomenology. That would be fascinating because sometimes we say that, you know, the necessary condition for, let's say, visualizing a color is activity in the occipital lobe. You know, you know better than I where that might be. But if there were some kind of experiments whereby that was halted and yet colors were still seen, we would know then that part of the brain was not a necessary condition for vision. Mm-hmm. And that would be very interesting because that would mean that, for a start then, we could not make numerically identical a color with that particular brain activity. And that would be interesting in itself because that would then rule out the psychoneural identity theory I was mentioning.
Yeah, you know, it would. That would, yes. You'd have to do that probably with cooling or some kind of ultrasonic. You know, it's not inconceivable. If we can actually shut off that area. It's an interesting thought experiment. Then, yeah, it may be practical at some point.
Another interesting one would be related to mental causation, so that the mind has an effect on the body. I mean, in a way, it's assumed when experiments use the placebo variable, of course, because that seems to be mental causation. But we could show that with psychedelics, a certain experiences themselves caused therapeutic benefits, as opposed to the neural mechanisms alone causing them, that would be very interesting because it would seem to suggest then a form of mental causation as therapeutic. How that experiment would be done exactly, I don't know, because you've just put me on the spot.
I think to some extent the experience those of us who research psychedelics have is somewhat supports that, because our own research and others have shown that it's the quality of the experience that produces the change. And we at present don't have a very clear, we can't predict the quality from the physiology, from the brain changes.
Mm.
And that kind of gets back to the sort of fundamental, I suppose, one of the constructs that we deal with in psychiatry, the Jaspers construct, which is, you know, there's the difference between kind of form and substance, you know.
Mm.
People, particularly in relation to psychosis, people, the nature of psychosis, say the nature of paranoia is the same. People are paranoid, but the content can be, you know, is utterly individual.
Right. Interesting.
And that's something much more to do with their mind and their experience than their brain, I imagine.
So interesting. If that could be proved then, so if it could be somehow evidenced that psychedelic experience had this direct causal mechanism from the phenomenology to the physiology, that would then have implications for the whole default view, as I said, of physicalism, and that really it's just, you know, all mechanism, and therefore anything one sees on psychedelics must be hallucination. It would rule that out. I mean, at least it would make it unstable.
That's a really interesting idea. Yeah, well, maybe you'll talk offline about how we'd have to reconfigure how we collected the data to really get access to that. But there is one experiment which we're doing at present, which I think you'll be intrigued by and have thoughts about. So we've done, Chris Timmerman and Robin Carhart-Harris have done DMT infusion. So DMT, as you know, is a rapid, fast onset.
NMDMT.
Yeah, dimethyltryptamine, that's right. And produces a very profound alteration in consciousness, often a sense that people go into another dimension. But in the other dimension, and often the other dimension is brighter, better, nicer. People like to usually get something positive from having been there. But also there's this sense of entities, the sense of interacting with some other being.
Mm.
And we are scanning the brains of people experiencing that.
Mm.
And we haven't done the analysis yet. It's complicated, and you know, there's a lot of data and takes a long time.
That's interesting.
But you know, where would that fit into with the sense of the other? Where does that fit into the philosophy of consciousness?
I mean, that's bordering on sort of theological territory there, and I'm sort of hesitant to talk about.
Well, yeah, I'm going to come to that in a minute. Yeah, I'm going to come to your teaching on religion.
It's a fascinating thing. I mean, it's a puzzle. It remains a puzzle to me as to why these entities, especially elvish entities,
yes,
are so prevalent under psychedelics.
Yes.
A number of theories, but none of them are, you know, solid. And so number one, that's a problem. On one end is, you know, one people would say that, well, these are real sentiences. They have their own perspective,
yes,
and they're communicating with you. And this would then link into the whole, you know, belief in angels,
correct,
and demons and so on of the past. On the other side, there would be people saying, well, it's just, you know, parts of your psyche trying to communicate with you and taking up certain forms, you know, archetypes, whatever they may be. Mm-hmm. That's also problematic because, you know, it's not, I mean, it's hard to prove that as well. So,
yes,
frankly, I don't know, you know.
No, I wasn't expecting you to. I just thought it's a topic for you to think about.
No, it's certainly a fascinating topic. And I've read Andrew Gallimore's book on DMT and his whole theory about different beings living in further dimensions of space and so on. I wrote a review of that book and I spoke to him about it. You know, very interesting, but ultimately I don't think it really works out either. Coming back to Humphrey Davy again, when he described one of his experiences, he said it was like... it was like, imagine if a fly suddenly gained the mind of a person. You know, they'd have no idea what was going on, you know. They would not be able to recognize anything or navigate themselves. And they'd come back in to fly world and they'd say, well, I just had an ineffable experience, right? and Davy was saying, this is, you know, Davy, like, you know, 200 years ago, so this is what it's like to have these mystical experiences. It could just simply be we are not humans, are not cognitively able to realize what the hell is going on. You know, there might be truths there of which, you know, human simply does not have the capacity to fathom in any way. You know, it's another possibility as well. I mean, one hopes not, but one should always be open to that.
Uh-huh, we haven't quite got, our brains aren't big enough, clever enough, smart enough.
No.
To understand yet.
Could be.
Religious people will say that's why you've got to believe in something bigger and better.
Well, I mean, you know, it's they do, but of course then immediately people will say, well, the motive for that is just to feel better about yourself and punish your enemies and see your loved ones, you know, after death and, you know, don't die. And so every which way you turn, there are problems on it, you know. But I think that you know, there are probably actual real truths to be yielded from psychedelic experience. I don't treat them simply as hallucinations. I see them as more like a presentations of puzzles that are yet to be understood.
Yeah, and that's again why I wanted you on the program, because I think you may, or philosophers may bring, and they certainly bring a way of questioning that certainly neuroscientists would never know about. And you may actually be bringing a new way of answering them as well, answering those puzzles.
Yeah. I think ultimately, you know, the philosopher's role is negative or critical. You know, they say, well, you shouldn't be sure about this. You know, you don't know, you can't say something is a hallucination unless you know the true nature of reality, which, you know, nobody does.
That's true. And I'm not going to, let's not dig too deep into that now. We've only got about 10 minutes left, and there's a few other things I want to talk to you about. So this concept of psychedelic exceptionalism, and this, Carl Hart in America has talked about this. Do you have any sympathy with that view?
Yeah, I mean, I can understand it. So, you know, with this psychedelic renaissance, there's this movement, this move to say, listen, we shouldn't think of psychedelics as drugs. You know, like heroin and cocaine, they are something exceptional, special, and they should be treated in a different class completely and so on. But his criticism then, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that, well, the problem with that is suddenly it then sort of makes heroin users and cocaine users who might be addicts seem even worse, as it were, you know, and lead to prejudice against them even more so. And I mean, yeah, sure, that's a danger. My view of it is simply that I would prefer all drugs to be regulated legally, drug use to be legally regulated, and that includes heroin and cocaine. So I'm in sympathy with that. However, I would add that, you know, psychedelics are exceptional, though, in the sense that they are the ones that yield these incredible experiences which are in a different class to cocaine and heroin. Although, as I said, with opium, and you know, heroin is a type of opiate, of course, they can also be yield these amazing visions. So I'm in two minds about it, really. I mean, I often say psychedelics shouldn't even be called drugs. They are more like, you know, some kind of mind expanders.
Yeah.
So in that sense, they're exceptional. But
it's a pejorative term, drugs, isn't it? Absolutely. And it's
more so in Britain, yeah. I mean, you know, in America, they have drug stores. We don't have that here. We have pharmacies, right? So that's probably even worse in England, Britain, than America. But another way to look at it is if you were to make psychedelics more acceptable in the mainstream, that would be a step onto the path of making other drugs acceptable over time as well. So I think we should be a bit careful to immediately denigrate these movements.
No, that's good. No, I think you're right. We should, and Carl's obviously thought long and hard about the issues of stigmatization of particularly of Afro-Caribbean drug users in the States who get a really bum deal.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, fair enough.
But I'm worried. I was asked to referee a paper today about the use of psychedelics, LSD, particularly in America. A survey has just been conducted, and it's showing an increased use in both middle-aged people and young people. And the strap line was, well, we've got to stop this. And I'm thinking, not entirely sure why that should be, because it's illegal.
Well, there you go. Back to the old chestnut, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And it's I'm slightly worried. I don't know if you're worried. I'm slightly worried that although that we are now in an era where there's a lot of discussion of psychedelics, both in the medical community, in the neuroscience community, in the spiritual community, in the philosophical community, even more after your conference, I'm not sure that, you know, I just still slightly worried that the establishment and or certainly the silent majority might be just stockpiling their weapons and there'll be a backlash. Does that worry you?
Yeah, it does. And I mean, as you emphasize in your book, you know, we have to stop this equation of immorality with illegality for a start. You know, this laws change all the time, and just because something's illegal doesn't mean it's therefore wrong. Yes. That's the first step. But your second point really is the risk, the danger, isn't it? Which is that at the moment, it's the psychedelic renaissance in full swing. However, it's still a small demographic, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. Could you suddenly get backlash against the Daily Mail something like this. That's a possibility, which is why it's perhaps important not to polarize the politics of the psychedelic circles at the moment. Because if you make it too left-wing, which it would more naturally swing to, I think, you would then alienate the right, and then you would get more backlash. If somehow it could be more inclusive, I mean, by, for example, considering that Albert Hofmann was centre-right, for example, who had discovered LSD.
Oh, was he? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he was, you know, one of his, the chapter in his book, LSD, My Problem Child, one of the chapters was devoted to his good friend Ernst Jünger, who coined the term psychonaut, another little-known German philosopher. But he was rather right-wing. I mean, he was he made his name by writing Storm of Steel, which is his time in the First World Wars as super soldier. And then he was a Nazi captain. But he was involved with the attempted assassination of Hitler, so that sort of saved him. I think he thought Hitler was too left-wing. So he was almost like...
too socialist,
right,
the
exactly.
National Socialist.
I mean, he was old high German, Prussian, you know. And so there is a history of all political science using psychedelics. And I think it's important to at least make that clear so that you don't have that potential backlash. Because that backlash would be horrific, because that would, you know, then influence politicians, laws, and then it would be much harder to get funding for experimentation and so on. So it's very important to have the public on your side for this.
Well, I think once you've got philosophers on your side, then everyone respects you guys, you know.
Well, it could be the opposite, actually.
I want to talk to you about time. You mentioned Bergström and this debate he had with Einstein, you know, that is time a real thing or is it a perception? And and one of the most, I mean, I remember my first time I even knew what a psychedelic was reading Hoffman's account of how it took him 7 hours or so to cycle home. That's telling us something about time perception, isn't it?
Yeah.
What does it tell a philosopher about time perception?
There's a lot of aspects to it. I mean, you know, Bertrand Russell, the epitome of English philosophy. He had a mystical experience, and not due to a psychedelic drug, but he wrote a book as well called Mysticism and Logic. And in it, one of the few criteria for a mystical experience was the unreality of time. So it seems from reports and experience that seeing sort of time stopping is quite a prevalent experience. And then you see that fits into a lot of idealism, because idealism, like Kant, they say that I mean, the argument is that time is not real, it's a projection of our minds, like space, like matter. As you see, what's crucial is idea. If that were real, if you were an idealist and you then had an experience which was timeless, that would be sort of experiential validation of a very what had hitherto been a very metaphysical point. I mean, that's one aspect of it. Another one is a lot of phenomenologists, so people who study, you know, don't care so much about the relation between matter and mind, but care more about what the mind actually is. One important aspect of that is analyzing the specious present, and that means the duration or the length of time of the present moment. And, you know, scientifically, you can't say how long the present is. There's not an absolute measure one can make. But nonetheless, in terms of experience, it is, you know, the prime aspect of reality. And and so it's very interesting to note that psychedelics can extend or contract that specious present. I mean, sometimes, for example, when you see trails, it's almost as if you're seeing, you know, a few seconds in one moment, right?
That's true. You are. Yes. Interesting.
Another interesting aspect about that is that, yeah, there is no absolute specious present. I mean, there's no objective reality as to how long the specious present is. It's conditioned by experience itself. So then by taking psychedelics, you're actually changing that duration, which is important in terms of understanding the nature of time in itself. I should also say, with regard to time, and, you know, Minkowski, Einstein's maths teacher, and Einstein himself, of course, claimed time was the fourth dimension of space.
Yes.
And that means really, and Einstein said in a letter to a bereaved widow that we in physics don't really believe in time. You know, this is an illusion created by our minds. So again, if that were to be the case, I mean, that's now physics rather than metaphysics, but if that were to be the case, then again, a psychedelic experience will not yield you mere hallucinations about time and species presence and so on. Mm-hmm. It might actually give you veridical knowledge, in other words, real knowledge.
Yes.
So I suppose, again, my point is negative. You know, you should be very careful about... Mm-hmm. Tagging things with the notion of a hallucination or illusion when we don't know the real reality of the world, the universe. And even, of course, Minkowski-Einsteinian relativity is, it's not universally agreed upon. And it doesn't, of course, famously cohere with quantum physics. So we know that science has not reached the end yet. We know that for sure. Physicists disagree in fundamental ways about the nature of reality, like, for example, whether there are 11 dimensions or 3 or 4. Yeah. So before we know that, we can't say that, you know, someone seeing 11 dimensions on DMT is a hallucination or not, right?
Peter, that's a fantastic place in which to stop. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your wisdom with us. And
my pleasure.
I'm looking forward to taking part in your conference. Do you want to tell people again when it is and what it's called so they can find it?
Yes, at the University of Exeter, starting from the 14th of April 2021 for 3 days, we will be holding then the philosophy of psychedelics. We'll have a number of philosophers speaking about different aspects of this emerging field. We've got an associated book, probably published by Bloomsbury, coming out hopefully on the same date as well. I'm looking forward to the joint paper that you and I might write on sort of the philosophy and the science of psychedelics, sort of bridging these two worlds. There's a website, philosophyofpsychedelics.com, where you can get a bit more information. It's Professor Christine Hauskeller, who's my supervisor there. She's sort of heading it in a way. But we've also got a lot of help from an organization and funding from certain Americans centered around the Center for Process Studies in America, which is fundamentally about Whitehead's philosophy. So there's a lot of interesting connections to be made. It's something very new. The tickets sold out almost immediately when we first put them on sale, but we had to, of course, reimburse everyone. But nonetheless, it will be popular. The ticket's not yet on sale, but...
Well, I'll tweet when they go on sale because I'm looking forward to being there. Yeah. Peter, thanks again. Thanks for sharing with us and keep up the good work.
You too, David.
I'll do my best and we'll speak soon and I look forward to writing that paper with you.
Excellent.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Wow, well, that was quite a tour de force of the history of psychedelics, the history of philosophy, the history of humankind almost, and with a bit of chemistry thrown in. Make a note of the books. I think they're probably all worth reading, but it'll probably take you a year or so to go through them. And of course, if you're interested, then maybe sign up to the conference at Exeter next year. And as soon as I know about it, I will tweet about it. So you can follow me on Twitter and find out. And of course, it would be great if you could all follow Drug Science on Twitter, share the podcast and share our cause and our vision with your friends. And ideally, become a Drug Science community member, because that way you support our enterprise, you support our vision, you get access to Drug Science events, and you progress us and everyone else telling the truth about drugs. Thank you for listening.